President Clinton, we welcome your address to our graduating students.
Thank you very much. President Hitt, Chairman Grindstaff, and the Board of Trustees, to the faculty members, the parents, and the graduates, I am really honored to be here. Some of you know that I am UCF's most ardent, unpaid flack. I love this place. It's big, diverse, energetic, and focused on the future. Congratulations on your 50th anniversary. You know, I want to thank you, too, for President Hitt. He and I were elected in the same year, and I've been out of office forever, and he's still here. And I think he's done a fine job. I'm glad to be here with all of you. I am well aware that for most graduates, the commencement address is the least important part of the ceremony. I am about to go back to Georgetown in just a few days to my 45th reunion. That's another way of saying I am old. But unlike most people, I actually remember who gave my commencement address and what he said. And here's why. It was the mayor of Washington, D.C., Walter Washington. And we had the commencement outside on the old lawn of the main campus. We were all there, decked out in our robes, just as you are, when, unforecast, this huge storm cloud came on out of nowhere. Just boom, there it was, lightning in the sky. Walter Washington looked at us, and here is what he said. If we don't get out of here, we're all going to drown. If you want to see my prepared remarks, contact me, and I will send them to you. Good luck. So I remember my commencement speaker's remarks. I did, however, learn an important lesson from them, because they were both brief and highly relevant, and I will try to be today. A few years ago, about a decade ago, a man named Richard Florida wrote a book called The Creative Class, which has recently been reissued. He said, the future belongs to places who have the three T's, talent, technology, and tolerance. As many of you know, I often cite a book by a journalist named William J. Bishop called The Next American Economy, which features Orlando and talks a lot about you at UCF and about the work that is done here between the public and private sectors in computer simulation because of all the money the Pentagon and NASA spend here on research in that field and because of Disney World and the Universal Theme Park and Global Entertainment Arts Video Game Division. But the larger point made in Mr. Bishop's trips around America, showing us places where good things are happening and featuring UCF, is that the most successful places, the places that have done the best at coming back from the awful financial crisis that began in late 2008, are the virtual jobless economy that existed before then. The places that are most successful are those where there is a very high level of cooperation and creativity, where people work together across the lines of business and government and foundations and other non-governmental organizations, across political lines, Republican, Democrat, Independent, where they embrace every kind of diversity they can get their hands on to try to find creative solutions to generate more jobs, more businesses, more opportunity, and stay in the future business. Now, this is really, really important, because if you ask some people, well, what will the future depend on? And they'll say, oh, it's all about technology, or all about finding a way for all of you to get a college degree without being bankrupt by debt, or doing a better job of creating enough jobs every year for the college graduates we have, and then steering our education programs so that they're actually training people for the jobs that will be there. All of these things. But I think underneath all that, the most important thing is whether we decide to share the future or try to own it for whatever groups we are a part of. I love Boston, and they've been very good to me over the years. And when I saw those explosions at the marathon, it broke my heart. And I realized that as the story came out, those young men who came here, I believe, looking to be part of a diverse, vibrant, future-oriented society, because of a confluence of events, were turned into a very different course. They chose conflict over cooperation, the clenched fist over the outstretched hand. You may remember a couple years ago, someone tried to blow up a car bomb in Times Square. That young man and his wife were both from Pakistan. They had come here. They gotten university degrees here. He had a job. He had a home mortgage. He had a good life. Then he lost his job, like a lot of people did, in the aftermath of the calamity, and his response was to go home, learn how to make a bomb, and come back and try to blow it up in Times Square, and we can only thank God that he didn't learn the lesson too well. But these sorts of thought patterns are things to which we are all subject. I don't mean murderous ones. I mean whether we're better off apart from the world or reaching out to it. I always say the most important finding of the human genome project, and I spent $3 billion of your money to sequence the human genome. And it was worth every penny of it. Because now, the latest survey I saw said that we had now benefited in more than $100 billion of extra activity because of that initial investment. And we haven't even scratched the surface of the biomedical benefits that are about to flow to all of us, especially when combined with diagnostics that use nanotechnology, which I spent $500 million of your money on to begin the work of trying to figure out how to accelerate the pace of nanotechnology development, figure out what the ethical as well as technical issues were, and integrate it into our health revolution. The most significant finding was that every difference that separates people categorically in the world, that is, if you just physical differences, look around this room, every non-age-related difference you can see is lodged in about 0.5% of our genome. Even our gender differences, only 0.5% of our genome. And yet, nearly all of us spend 99.5% of our time obsessed with that 0.5% difference. I plead guilty. Wish I were a little taller. If I had a 4-foot vertical jump, I could have gone in a different line of work. Wish I were just a little bit smarter. Why did Einstein get a brain so much bigger than mine? You know, it's not just politics. We're all like that. And because we want to be special, because we want our lives to have meaning, if we're not careful, it's too easy to fall into defining ourselves in terms of negative reference. I was reading something about a year ago by a guy who said, you know, America's come a long way. We're not as sexist as we used to be. We're not as racist as we used to be. We're not as bigoted against people of different religions as we used to be. We're not as homophobic as we used to be. We just have one remaining bigotry. We don't want to be around anybody who disagrees with us. And you're laughing, but I'll give you one more book. If you read a book by called The Big Sort, S-O-R-T, by a journalist named Bill Bishop, he tells this hilarious story that provoked him to write the book. He lived in Austin, Texas, in a heavily Democratic neighborhood with one Republican neighbor. He loved this guy. Their children played together. They walked together every day. They argued and debated everything, and they learned from each other. Apparently, he was the only person in the neighborhood who was nice to this guy. So he moved across town. In Bishop's neighborhood, when President Bush defeated now Secretary of State John Kerry, Kerry carried that neighborhood 3-1. When he moved across town, he moved into a neighborhood where Bush defeated Kerry 4-1. Everybody thought just like him. And the author said, I thought to myself, both neighborhoods are poor. And there's lots of evidence of this. James Surowiecki's book, The Wisdom of Proud, points out that there are lots and lots and lots of studies that show if you take any 20 of you and put you in a room and put in another room the person with the highest IQ in the United States, and we keep feeding into each room one problem after another, one social problem after another, one economic problem after another, you name it, that over time, the room full of the rest of you will make better decisions than the lone genius. We need each other. We need to grow together. We need to work together. As Bishop says in his book, Celebrating Orlando and Celebrating UCF, it works because there's a high level of cooperation and people are interested in getting things done. This is going to be very important in both rich countries and developing countries. In developing countries, we need to figure out how, given the money people have, we can build systems that work. That's what I do with my foundation. We're now trying to save 1 million children's lives from waterborne diseases by getting oral rehydration therapy and zinc to people. Nobody needs to die of that. 80% of the people who do, of the 1 million people a year who do, are under 5 years of age. In America, we have to figure out how we can continue to improve health care and improve health and not have this massive gap between what we spend, now about 17.9% of GDP on health care, and what every other big rich country spends. Next big rich country is France at 11.8% of GDP, Germany at 11.5%. The difference is about $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year not being invested in new jobs, new businesses, pay raises, research and development, you name it. And we have to figure out how to do that while increasing coverage for people long denied. And this is not a walk in the park. And a lot of it will require us to live differently. We spend about somewhere between $150 and $200 billion a year more than we would if we had the lifestyle habits of nearly any other country. We are living with the consequences of our number one public health problem, childhood obesity, which is going to lead to an explosion of type 1 diabetes and its attendant consequences unless we turn it around. And yet we know that with lifestyle changes, many people who already have type 1 diabetes can get rid of it. So medicine in the 21st century will be a dizzying combination of pushing the envelope in the latest scientific discovery and constantly re-examine non-medical behaviors. How do we eat? How do we exercise? How do we grow food? How do we process food? How far does it travel? What are the consequences? You can't solve all these problems if you're mad. And nobody knows enough to solve them all. They developed over decades, and there was no devil involved. It's going to require a high level of creative cooperation. I spend time in places where farmers lose half their income because they have to pay somebody else to take their crops to market, and they live 12 miles down a road so rough it takes an hour and a half to traverse it, and they have no means of transport for their food. There's no left or right way to solve that problem. There's a way you have to cooperate to create a whole new reality. So I want you to think about that. And I want you to think about the power that you have, both in the jobs you will take and in the world you live in beyond your job. People of modest incomes have more power to change the course of history now than ever before. When the tsunami hit South Asia, Americans gave $1 billion. A lot of people gave big money, but the median contribution was $56. Why? It was the first major natural disaster in the world where large numbers of people contributed over the internet. When the earthquake hit Haiti, where I have spent a lot of the last 4 years working, America gave $1 billion. And several people gave over $1 million. But the median contribution there was $26. Why? Because you could get on your cell phone, type in Haiti, and any number of different charities had different numbers, and $10 would automatically be transferred. Technology is empowering you not just to do what you came here to study to do, but also to be citizens in the non-governmental movement, which is just a fancy way of saying private people trying to advance the public interest. And I hope you will do that, each and every one of you. The world you live in is more full of possibilities than any age in human history. It is also limited by the fact that our imaginations and perhaps even our hearts don't see that there's too much poverty, too much inequality, too much instability, that our model of producing and consuming energies and other resources is not sustainable, and all these things together are holding us in. But the thing that holds us in most is that too many of us still believe our differences are more important than our common humanity. And our differences matter. We can all be glad Einstein was born with a bigger brain than we have. We can all get into the NBA playoffs and wish we could do what LeBron James does. We can all think these things. But in the end, we have to believe that our common humanity matters more. The successes of UCF, and I look out at this crowd and I look at the families here, the successes of Orlando that have been chronicled now by observant outsiders, they are all testimony to the fact that no matter how smart we are, how righteous we are, how close to the truth we are, we all do better when we work together, when we share prosperity, when we share responsibilities, when we share membership in a community. And you know, every year we have a Clinton Global Initiative just for university students, and several times UCF students have come. And they had, I thought the neatest, because you had a guy here in this year at Washington University in St. Louis who's a disc jockey who said he was going to do all of his radio shows and his other disc jockey work with solar power. I thought that was pretty cool, to demonstrate that it was widely available for new and creative uses. But listen to this. In 2010, two UCF students, Christopher Castro and Henry Harding, created a group called Intellectual Decisions on Environmental Awareness Solutions, or IDEAS. And it was all focused on research and action into solutions that would give you a more sustainable future. They had no money. They didn't know what was going to happen. They just kept plugging away. Pretty soon, all these national organizations, including the White House, recognized them as great change agents. And today, this group is called Ideas for Us. It's a global non-governmental organization, accredited by the United Nations, winning a lot of awards, with more than 10,000 followers, 25 chapters in the United States, and operations in 15 countries. It all started here with two people just like you. And so here's what I have to say in the end. You know what the most important thing about your degree is? And its relevance to the future? It is incredibly empowering. Most of the people who have ever lived on planet Earth, indeed, a vast number of people alive today, never had the choice that these roads and mortarboards and your degree gives you. Most people who have ever lived never had a choice in what they did for a living. You have been given that. Even in a tough economy, you've been given that. And my advice is, do what makes you happy. Most people are happiest doing what they're best at. Most people are happiest both doing well and doing good, doing something for someone else. I hope you will do well. I hope you will do good. I hope you will have a good time doing it. I'm going back to my 45th reunion, and those 45 years passed in the blink of an eye. So embrace this. You are literally living in the age of greatest possibility. The only real question is whether our minds can expand and our hearts can open enough to make it a new golden age instead of one techno nightmare after another. It is a question of mind and heart. You have the know-how. You have the mind. You have the heart. Don't let them go. Good luck and God bless you.